The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. In this week's extracts, we're asking Liam Halligan to read out his piece about quantitative easing and the dangers, Lionel Shriver to discuss the vanity of white guilt, and Yacenda Max de Graham on the perils facing choirs. First, Liam Halligan.
The FTSE 100 index of leading stocks is over 20% up since Britain went into lockdown. That's bull market territory. The government borrowed £55 billion in May, 9 times more than the same month last year. Yet borrowing costs are down, with some investors now paying to lend to an increasingly indebted nation. Who cares if the UK economy will shrink some 10% this year, as our national debt rockets over 100% of GDP? Stocks are up, bond prices are up, and the laws of economics have been suspended. It's different this time. And all because of quantitative easing. Back in 2009, with the global banking system on the brink of collapse, QE was a justifiable emergency measure. But this one-off post-crisis necessity has now morphed into a lifestyle choice. For a decade since the financial crisis, QE has pumped up share prices and suppressed bond yields, allowing governments to borrow cheaply. But as state spending has surged post-COVID, we've become dependent. QE is now the economic equivalent of crack cocaine. Originally a £50 billion temporary rescue measure, the Bank of England, egged on by city financiers and high-spending politicians, expanded QE over 10 years to around £450 billion. Since March, it's ballooned again into a £745 billion binge, with our central bank now buying government debt twice as fast as in 2009-10. The combined balance sheet of the Federal Reserve in America, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan has similarly swollen since COVID by a third over the past 3 months. So QE's no problem. Everyone's doing it. Much of our political and media class has indeed concluded that interest rates are low and will stay low so the governments can keep borrowing. Debt service costs are manageable is now part of the Westminster lingo. But what if the bond markets rebel and market interest rates spike whatever the Bank of England says and does? The immediate problem is that QE is deeply counterproductive. Hosing economies with liquidity doesn't make them grow faster. That's like trying to get fat by buying a bigger belt. Earning no interest on savings and being paid to borrow also distorts basic economics. Central bank bond buying has kept far too much capital locked up in over-indebted zombie companies too, resulting in low productivity. This monetary excess has made financial investors more reckless, with markets losing their ability to correct, witness sky-high valuations amid crashing growth. That's astonishingly dangerous, setting us up for collapse. Many real-world investors, meanwhile, business owners and those taking direct stakes in companies, have been so spooked by this monetary madness that they're keeping money off the table, stymieing growth even more. But QE hasn't led to inflation, its acolytes say, and it won't in the future. Oh, but it has. Much of the central bank's funny money has so far stayed within the financial system, generating stock and bond market bubbles, as well as bloating property prices. And if bank lending now expands across the broader economy, as the government hopes, inflation will follow QE as night follows day. By holding back bond market vigilantes for now, QE is facilitating vast government debts that will come back to haunt us. Monetary policy is now so deranged that around a fifth of all global debt has a negative yield, retarding global growth and storing up huge systemic dangers. Amid already massive monetary expansion, the Westminster City consensus is that we need even more, as the Bank of England prepares to yank UK interest rates deep into negative territory. Yet sterling is not a reserve currency, and we have a huge trade deficit, this cannot end well. Our QE, stock market, bond market, Ponzi scheme must be recognised for what it is. We need to break our QE dependency and encourage others to do the same. What's needed is a retreat from this monetary frenzy, cooling financial markets in a bid to restore normality and balance as the post-COVID global economy reboots.
That was Liam Halligan, now Lionel Shriver.
When I was about 10, on return home from church, I ate a peach, the juice of which dribbled down my new pink frock. I scuttled to my room to change, bunching the dress under the bed. I emerged the picture of innocence, but I felt guilty. For weeks, the garment pulsed with accusation. Going to sleep, I always knew it was there. Sure enough, my mother discovered the wad while vacuuming, and she was furious. She could have scrubbed out the juice had I told her about it right away. To this day, I'm mindful that you can only expunge stains while they're still fresh. And somewhere in there lurks a metaphor. I'm not prone to remembering the ingestion of individual pieces of fruit. That small memory looms as a touchstone for the experience of culpability. I'd not acted responsibly, and I'd compounded my malfeasance with concealment. When called out, I hung my head with nothing to say for myself. The last thing I felt inclined to do was tear outside and advertise to the whole neighborhood that I'd been a bad little girl. Though the concept of collective white guilt has been with us since at least the 1960s, it's seen quite the fashionable resurgence in the wake of the George Floyd protests last month. As universities, businesses, and celebrities fall all over themselves to banner their racial blameworthiness, pale-faced mea culpas gather into a deafening chorus. The issues are two. First, one of this column's running themes, emotional fraudulence. Clarion declarations of moral dereliction do not have the texture of guilt. They are prideful. They have the texture of preening. Elaborate racial apologies are a form of showing off. When last month the actress Jenny Slate resigned from the animated Netflix show Big Mouth because voicing a half-black character was an example of white privilege and an act of erasure of black people within a system of societal white supremacy, she wasn't making a career sacrifice, but bidding for elevated status. Bet it works, too. Bet the lady isn't short of work for long. FYI, a backhanded boast of my own. My latest novel anticipates white audiobook readers and voiceover artists being forbidden the mimicry of speaking as non-white characters. The prescience is depressing. We're witnessing the spectacle of white people frantically competing with other white people over who can appear more self-excoriating, more self-loathing. But these people don't hate themselves. They hate other people, mythical other people for the most part, all those terrible racist white folks to whom they can feel vastly superior. Now that white silence equals violence, they can also feel superior to regular going about their business white people who haven't managed to get prostrate pronouncements of self-disgust on BuzzFeed. These confessions are also defensive. They're diversionary and an attempt to opt out. They translate as, "You don't want to come for us. We're on your side. We're allies. We're the nice white people. And because there's no such thing as nice white people, that means we're not really white after all. So you don't want to burn down our premises, right? You want to go for those horrible white people over there. Here, take some petrol and matches on us, and we won't call the cops. Honest." Yet ask Adam Rappaport, forced to resign as editor of Bon Appetit over an ancient brown face. The opt-out doesn't work. You get canceled anyway. when your unseemly Black Lives Matter groveling is deemed insufficiently pious. Proper guilt feels bad. Its emotional cousin, shame, feels even worse. Whenever I leaked a bit because I didn't want to come in from playing outside, my mother forced me to wash out my panties by hand in the sink in front of my brothers. Behold, shame. Adult examples of shame in my life I'd be reluctant to share here. Shame is soul-destroying, the stuff of suicide. You don't parade shame in public. You're unlikely to leave the house. So none of last month's white protesters was ashamed. Issue 2. We're in danger of installing heritable guilt as morally valid. Now that we're to embrace the concept of an ineradicable systemic racism, while employees take mandatory courses on unconscious bias, bigotry is no longer a sin we choose or refuse to perpetuate, but a stain handed down through the generations that's just as indelible as the peach juice on my pink dress. Is this what we want? Really? Will we stick modern Mongolians with the rampages of Genghis Khan? Hold some 19-year-old Muscovite today, responsible for Stalin's gulags. Force Germans to keep expiating their little hearts out over the Second World War in the year 3000? Maybe we should enlarge the lens. Frankly, I'm weary of the whole category white people, which throws folks of wildly different backgrounds, from Russians to Jews to Scots, into one big indiscriminate pot. So let's talk about people, full stop. As a species, we've been treating each other like shit from the year dot. The horrors to which we've subjected one another, including slavery but a great deal else, are so incomprehensibly dreadful that no one, as an individual, could conceivably bear the crushing weight of all that torture, mass murder, and sadism. If guilt is inherited, then every last one of us should be condemned to Dante's 9 circles of hell. None of us chose the world in which we emerged. We didn't pick our race, sex, or natal nationality. Any inbuilt leg up or disadvantage these traits conferred at birth was not of our making. We didn't select which awful history soaks the ground at our feet. It's insensible to feel guilty or ashamed about something you didn't do. It's entirely sensible to feel regret, sorrow, and abhorrence about the likes of slavery. It's commendable to be informed about the past and to try to understand the nature of its wretchedness, as it's also commendable to strain to leave the world a little better than you found it. But claiming that what happened before you were born is all your fault is not only ridiculous, it's vain.
That was Lionel Shriver, now Yacinda Maxton Graham.
Britain's choirs are facing oblivion, yet they're also terrified of returning. One story explains why. Picture this innocent choral society scene in Skagit County, Washington State, on the evening of the 10th of March. 120 singers, most of them elderly sopranos, gathered in the Presbyterian Church to rehearse for 2 hours, their chairs 15 centimetres apart. At half-time, they took a break for shared snacks, and at the end, the helpful ones stayed to stack the chairs. 52 of those singers came down with COVID-19, supposedly through release of aerosol droplets in the ether. Thus began the swirling of rumours across the world about the grave dangers of singing. It has still not lifted, in spite of the pleas of choral directors, that it was the finger food and the chair stacking rather than the singing that spread the disease, and that those people were old, whereas many cathedral choirs have no one over the age of 40, and that if you hold a candle flame in front of a well-trained singer, the flame will not even flicker, so controlled is his or her breath. This week, in an operating theatre at the government's science facility at Porton Down, a small group of guinea pig choral singers, some professional and some amateur, are taking part in experiments to measure what happens to those aerosols, droplets measuring 0.005 of a millimetre or less, when they are emitted by the singing voice. Similar experiments are going on in London, conducted by Declan Costello, a consultant surgeon specialising in the human voice, who also happens to be a tenor in Polyphony and the Holst Singers. A lot is resting on these experiments, he tells me. If the result is not what we want to hear, well, at least Public Health England can make a decision based on science. At the moment, we have no real data. It's not a situation that's ever needed to be studied. I dread to think what will happen if the results are bad. It was grim enough on Sunday to see the Dean of York presiding from behind a plastic visor and holding up the wafer wearing a blue latex glove. If our nation's science prefects become armed with new anti-singing data, there'll be no communal choral singing for months or years. And the absurd situation could arise in which children are allowed to sing at school, which they are, in groups of up to 15, but not in cathedrals with their vast interior spaces. Meanwhile, choristers' voices are breaking, the rhythm of daily psalm singing has been halted, and a jewel of Britain, our world-leading choral tradition, is in danger of being damaged irreparably. Such is the blunt instrument of the furloughing scheme that many directors of music haven't even been allowed to conduct Zoom rehearsals with their choristers, as all work is forbidden under the scheme. Even if the portion down results are good, will cathedrals still be able to fund their choirs? York Minster has had to close its Minster School with immediate effect. The Dean explained that because of the sharp drop in tourist numbers owing to the virus, the cathedral's expected annual income of 9.4 million will have a shortfall of 5.2 million. Thankfully, the choristers will all go to St. Peter's School 10 minutes walk away, so the news is not quite as bad as it seems. That kind of financial shortfall will be replicated in all cathedrals, the worst hit being the ones that raked in money from charging entry to tourists. As choirs cost a minimum of £250,000 a year to run, one can imagine belt-tightening deans and chapters making small tweaks such as lowering the number of choral services per week or cutting the numbers of paid back-row singers. Hearts sank this week at the news that St. Margaret's Westminster and Holy Trinity Sloane Street have both disbanded their professional choirs. Disband. Abolish. These are the new chilling words. Members of congregations were seen dabbing their eyes on Sunday, so moved were they to be back in their local cathedral under the new rules. Service is allowed, but you have to book a slot, and no hymns. The permitted music is organ plus one solo singer. Even that small gesture of live music felt like a luxury. Cathedral music has returned to the pre-Vatican II sound, organ verses alternating with lines of solo plainsong. Unsung heroes are doing their best to save the situation. Peter Allwood, chairman of Friends of Cathedral Music, launched the Cathedral Choir's emergency fund that has raised £830,000 out of a hopeful million to help sustain cathedrals at least through Christmas and Easter. Will any of the government's £1.5 billion bailout for the arts go towards cathedral choirs? Does the government even see them as part of the arts, as they surely are? In the past, the doctrine of stand on your own two feet has been ruthlessly applied to cathedrals far more than to theatres and opera houses, so I'm not very hopeful. We need our choirs back. Cathedrals are vast. Singers can stand far apart from each other in a semicircle. It's time for common sense to take charge.
That was Yucinda Maxton-Graham, and that's it from Spectator Out Loud this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu. And if anyone has got comments about this or any other podcast that we do, please email them, because it's always great to hear from you. It's podcast@spectator.co.uk.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.